and welcome to the Handbag Designer 101 podcast with your host, Emily Blumenthal, handbag designer expert and handbag fairy godmother, where we cover everything about handbags from making, marketing, designing, and talking to handbag designers and industry experts about what it takes to make a successful handbag. Welcome, Aaron Luo, co-founder and CEO of Cara. I am so excited to have you here as part of the Handbag Designer 101 podcast. In advance, I apologize for my scratchy voice. Hopefully that'll make it that much more interesting hearing me on this level. But Aaron, thank you for being here.
This is so cool. It's a pleasure. We've known each other for a long time, and I think it's going to be an exciting conversation. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, I think I am more than you. So let's just jump right in. So you are Chinese, but born in Spain, correct?
That's right. That's correct. Yeah. I was born in Shanghai, China. Grew up there up until fourth grade, and then moved to Madrid, Spain, and that's where I grew up. I feel very much as Chinese, as Spaniard, as American, just because now I've lived in the States for 20 plus years. But yeah, came to the States for school, kind of stayed, did the bachelor, the business school, the whole shebang. And
everything that a nice, responsible, respectful Chinese child should do.
Yep.
Checked all those boxes.
Checked them all and followed the path, per se. And yeah, it's been living in the U.S. for 20 plus years. You know, I travel extensively. You know, didn't first come to fashion right away, even though my family has always been in fashion for 20 plus years.
Wait. Let's go back. Now, what is someone from China moving to Spain doing? And how many Chinese kids were there in your class?
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting and funny question. So I moved there because my grandfather moved there. You know, matter of fact, he was one of the earlier Chinese to establish himself in Spain. And because of that, of course, you know, he ended up bringing up, you know, the entire family out in Spain. And honestly, there's just maybe
your mom's side or dad's side?
My mom's side.
So your dad went along with it?
Yeah, you know, my dad back then also traveled quite a bit. You know, you got to realize this is, you know, China in the 80s and 90s, right? Where, you know, the economical and social situations wasn't as desirable as it is now.
So you were an only child then?
I was only child.
As you do.
And then as, you know, first generation immigrant, you know, from my parents' side, you know, they're looking for their good fortune, you know, for their kids and for themselves and so on and so forth. So because of my grandfather connection, of course, you know, we ended up in Spain. And it's a lovely country. It's a lovely country. I loved it. But to answer your question, honestly, there just weren't that many Chinese, you know.
That must have been hard. Like
in the early days, for sure, you know, as an immigrant kid, you know, in a country where, you know, everybody is different. Now, given Spain is a very welcoming country, you know, nevertheless, I think there's definitely that culture shock for me, right? In the early days, I moved there when I was nine and a half, almost 10. And I literally, my parents kind of threw me into a Catholic school and all boys Catholic school and zero Spanish, you know.
Different uniform.
Uniform. Exactly. So, you know, for the first 2 years, it's a healthy combination of not really know what's going on and a healthy amount of fights, you know, as happens in boys school.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you know, little boy stuff. But no, it was a very interesting childhood, you know, raising or growing up in Spain. Like I said, it's a wonderful country. As a Spaniard, as I feel, you know, American or Chinese. And part of the reason why we ended up starting a second brand, which, you know, we can talk about that later on, it's because I feel very connected to Spain, you know, both me and my co-founder. So, but yeah, it was an interesting childhood. Loved it. And
not many people can speak to that combo. You know, like you were like a double minority.
It really was. You know, back then Spain was, you know, and I forget the percentage, but, you know, very high percentage, you know, basically Spaniard Catholics.
Right.
And yeah.
It's not like you were in South America where at least Brazil and so forth, there's gigantically high Japanese population, even Asian. By going to Spain, which is such a uniform culture. Like double culture shock, throw yourself in. And then obviously being Chinese, you had to still be the top of the top.
Double ammo. Yeah, it really was. You know, honestly, some of my most fond memories of my life, you know, not just my childhood, really happened in Spain. My best man at my wedding, you know, was my childhood friend from Spain. Every year I go back, I still see all my friends and we catch up and goof around. Anyways.
Your wife is not from there. She's from here.
That's right. My wife is American. Yep.
So you went there, and then what made you say that, okay, now being in Europe, that gives you an edge because you could have honestly gone to any university. Why come to America and pay full price?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know what? It sounds like you really know your stuff. You kind of know in navigating through the different educational system. But yes, growing up in Spain, easily you could go to a top university for free.
For like $1.50, if anything.
If anything. Matter of fact, I mean, you know, I think back then they didn't have these kind of programs, but, you know, later on, they actually even subsidized your school, right? To go to school and all that. But
could you imagine that?
I know, right?
What did I do wrong?
But, you know, I love the U.S. You know, in the summers, I have family in the States, right? So, you know, when I was in my teenage years, two summers I spent in the States. I loved it. Well, my family is in Maryland, but, you know, I traveled quite a little bit when I was in my teenagers through YMCA program. I came here, did a consular thing. It was hilarious.
That must have been amazing. Like coming in, being like, wow, like, yeah. Look at me. I didn't know I could carry so much weight as a double foreigner.
And you know what? And I feel very connected with America to a certain extent, right? Because I saw a lot of Asian Americans, you know, because to your point earlier, right? Coming from Spain, where I saw maybe two Chinese kids of my age come to the States. It's such a diverse community.
Oh my God, there are more of me. Who knew?
There was bubble tea and Chinese food, you know, like it's like, which back then did not exist in Spain back in those days. And so fell in love with the country. Also really saw the opportunities that this country represents.
Yeah.
You know, Spain, as wonderful as a country it is economically, right? It's not as, you know, advanced as countries like the States. And I wanted more. I had that fire in me, I guess you can say, to really kind of make it for myself. And, you know, obviously, I don't think I've ever said this in public, but staying away from my parents or being away from my parents is exciting. Exactly. Right. Like, Lord, I can go to college and, you know, without my parents breathing down my neck.
And just be, like, just finally not have to follow and do what's expected, you know, stay out late, drink, do all the crazy things that God forbid you ever did anywhere else.
That's right.
You know, pre-social media, of course. So no one, they would have no account of knowing.
No idea what am I doing. You know, there's the monthly phone call, if any, you know, and that's kind of it. The only rule or condition, I guess, they put forward is that I had to study engineering.
Oh my God.
Which, you know, honestly, in hindsight, I'm glad I did just because it taught me how to solve problems. I honestly did not really care about electrical engineering. I mean, don't even ask me how, you know, certain complex circuits work, because I really didn't care too much.
I got to tell you, you're not the only Asian designer I've worked with who had a suggested and then in parentheses forced major of engineering, and it's like, well, it wasn't all bad because now I know how to make things. I know how to, you know, reverse engineer, how to take things apart and see things in black and white, as opposed to like, let me just start a business, let me just become a designer, let me just go into something that I know absolutely nothing about and try to be a success.
I think you're right on, and that was the thinking, right? And I think, you know, bless my parents' heart in terms of wanting to build or form me, right, in a certain path or a certain way. Like I said, I walked away with basically problem-solving skills. I think that's the key thing I walked away with. I knew I was going to go to business school after. I didn't want to go to business school right away, but my parents are entrepreneurs. They always have been. I grew up, you know, in the early days washing dishes and, you know, waiting waitressing tables. And
what did they have? What was their business?
Well, they were serial entrepreneurs. So we started with a chain of Chinese restaurants back in the
early days. What was it called?
Well, there were a couple. You know, the names were the kind of typical Chinese restaurants. One is called Yinbing, which is translates to welcoming. And the second one's called Casa de Bamboo, which translates to house of bamboo. You know, and then we had another one called Meisan. You know, there were a few others that we, you know, they either helped to operate or invested in. But point is that I grew up, you know, watching them. And then later on,
and then seeing that anything was possible, like, hey, let's just start a business. And here's the template. We know what to get. We know how to build. We know how to serve. I mean,
that's right.
Gold. I mean,
for a child. Yeah, I agree.
100%
for a child. You know, I grew up understanding the value of hard work, because restaurants, you
oh my God,
bust your butts, you know, hard work, you know, customer service,
Yeah.
Supply chain, you know, if you really kind of translate to big words like supply chain. So, you know, again, hated it back then when I had to wash dishes on Fridays. But taught me great values. But later on, they switched to fashion. They had an opportunity to, you know, basically start working on supply chain and fashion, handbag specifically, actually.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that ended up being a heritage business for the Luo family. I had no idea.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough to work with several large Italian luxury brands.
How did the switch over from food to fashion happen?
Through a series of investments, actually. Basically started with investing in the factory, then, you know, saw an opportunity to operate the factory, started building a network. Then through our roots in Europe, a lot of, you know, European brands start to, you know, my dad, you know, is a good networker and ended up being acquainted with a lot of brands.
Had they moved back to China or they stayed in Spain for all of this?
A little split, you know, so it was a little bit of, you know, part of the family in Spain, part of family start operating in China. Like I said, fortunately for us, you know, that was the time where a lot of European brands starting to venture into China to expand their manufacturing footprints. You know, we did have actually a small factory in Florence as well, and, you know, ended up actually closing that and, you know, basically fully moving to Southeast China. Wow. And so, yeah, so that's kind of, you know, what.
And what were you when all this was happening? Were you out of college? Or were you still in college?
I was in high school.
You were still living in Spain when this whole evolution went from food to handbags. And now everybody's having to get acquainted with leathers and silhouettes and how materials and structure and just throw them. I bet your home was then all of a sudden filled with a whole bunch of samples out of nowhere.
Samples everywhere. You know, I was that kid that instead of watching or reading, you know, video game magazines, I was reading Vogue just because that was the only thing around. You know, my parents basically, you know, had all these fashion products and magazines and materials where, you know, as a little kid, that was the first thing that you pick up when you were around the house and so on. So really kind of got a sense of fashion introduction for my parents, you know, venturing into the fashion world from that perspective and fascinated by it. Love, you know, the fashion side of things. I actually was a lot more interested in the retail side of the things as far as, like, you know, the different stores that the brands open, and of course fascinated by the glam, you know.
Who
wouldn't be, you know, fascinated by that side of the fashion? You know, also kind of got very interested in the manufacturing side. You know, I think most people, if you haven't really been in a manufacturing environment or setting, right? And you know this, Emily.
Yeah.
You walk into a factory and it's mesmerizing. I mean, there's some factories that you probably don't get mesmerized, but, you know, and I've been in those.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them. There's like, wow, you know, like this is where, you know, a Prada bag comes to life, or, you know, this is where, you know, a Dior bag, you know, comes to life, right?
But let me ask you something. So where did you go to college?
University of Massachusetts in the States.
Okay.
For my undergrad.
Okay. So you're there. You've escaped your family. Thank God. Bye. I get a monthly phone call, if that, whatever. It's really interesting to me because anybody with a background like yours, I can even say like mine, the mindset is that was interesting. I'm sure I learned a lot by osmosis, but it's the last thing I'm ever going to get involved with. I have no desire, nothing. I'm going to go into something totally different. So when you accidentally end up going back into it, it's almost like your head is kind of down when you go to your parents being like, so, hey, guys, I've got an idea. Hey, guys, like, or was it your parents like, listen, when you're ready, you're coming back. How did all that manifest? So you graduated and then what?
Yeah, it's the former. You know, it's very interesting, right? So I was very fascinated by the whole fashion thing, but I knew that I didn't want to just do manufacturing and supply chain, you know, to a certain extent. You know, especially back in the
interesting but not sexy.
And not just that, I feel like, you know, in the early 2000s, right? I feel, you know, especially once I started getting educated with American education and started learning about supply chain operations and so on and so forth. To a certain extent, I felt that was a little bit of a commodity to a certain extent, right?
Totally.
In the sense that, you know, you with the right connections, which a lot of people have connections, with the right connections and with a little bit of, you know, perhaps rigor or discipline, you could get into a really great factory. You don't need to operate it, right?
Correct.
To some extent.
Correct.
What really fascinated me was the branding side. Branding, retail. So that was very fascinating to me. I don't think I'm that smart of a business person, but I was smart enough to know that I did not have what it takes to run a brand or nor a right. company. So I knew I was foolish if I was going to go back to my dad and say like, hey, look, I'm graduating from college. I did what you said. And I'm a big man now coming out. Let me get an executive position in your company, right? I mean, first of all, he probably would slap me and say, you know, no, you're going to start in the warehouse.
Right.
And but second of all, I just knew I didn't have it, right? So I, right after college, I actually wanted to go and work for an American company. There's several in my mind that I really wanted to work for, really to learn process, operations, finance. You know, there's certain functions and skill sets that I think any business person, whether you're in fashion, whether you're in tech, or whether you're in any other industry, that if you don't have it, I think, you know, you are handicapped.
Well, and you just called that a very important point of this recognition to get paid to learn. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I think, don't see the value in that or just want to try and skip steps. But by skipping steps, you not only lose time, lose money, and the sunk costs of that learning curve are extreme. So, 100%. You know, check to you, Aaron, for figuring that out very early, saying, let me figure this out. Let me learn something else. Let me have someone pay me for it and then see what I need to do.
Yeah. And that was the idea that I wanted to trip. I wanted to fail to a certain extent, right? I wanted to get beat up.
On somebody else's time.
Well, and somebody who is not going to be cuddling me, right? Because, you know, the reality is that if you join a family business and your family, right, your uncles and your dad are the head of the family, you're going to get cuddled. You know, you're going to get cuddled. Well, I think in Chinese culture, yes. Even though I think, you know, again,
abusive on the inside, but coddled on the outside.
Yeah. And the worker, right? You're going to start from the bottom. Even your managers will treat you differently. I know this because I've seen it, right?
My cousins, right.
So forth. So I wanted to get beat up a little bit on my own by Western cultures to a certain extent. And I got my fair share.
You hadn't been enough already?
No. Because I mean, you know, you go through college. College is, and I joke around, college is somewhat of a vacation to a certain extent. No, in the best of ways, right? Because, I mean, you are in such a kind of controlled environment. You're there to learn, you know. Yes, you have off-campus jobs, but come on, let's face it. Those are...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's...
100%. Yes.
So, I loved college. I mean, I was like, this is heaven. I mean,
oh, my God. If I could go back, like... Magic. I know. I feel the same way. Like walking around with a backpack, being stressed about a test. Come on, give it to me.
So yeah, so I really wanted to, like I said, the key thing is I knew I didn't know finance. I didn't know operations. You know, I didn't know processes. I didn't know the rigor of quarterly closing or short-term outlooks. I mean, you know, there's so many things I learned from General Electric. So, you know, General Electric GE was one of the key brands or businesses that I really, really wanted to join. Back then, I read a book from Jack Welch.
Yeah.
I don't feel...
he was like this on the cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
He actually went to my school and his fraternity actually was next to my fraternity. And anyways, I got exposed to GE very early on in my days in college and loved the concept of a conglomerate, got fascinated by the company in general. And I say, look, there's few, right? There's McKinsey, there's GE, there's few others out there. And I said, if I was going to pick a company to work for, these are the guys, right, that I need to kind of cut my teeth in. And fortunately enough, I was, you know, offered a great role with GE, actually back in my junior day. So they locked me in my junior year.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
The magic summer tap, like, we want you back. That was very lucky.
That was very lucky. I mean, you know, I like to say that I did work hard. That's
true.
But it was dream come true. So, you know, spent 10 years with GE, primarily in operations and finance, dabbled into merchant acquisitions a little bit too, towards the end. Before I left, I was a CFO for one of their operations, which was very
exciting. Pretty young for you to be doing that at that age, weren't you?
And that's the reason why I wanted to join GE, right? There are several companies that I knew that they, if you're good and you're willing to work your butt off, like truly your butt off, and you're willing to make certain sacrifices, they tap you. They give you the opportunity. And which is something to be said about, you know, GE. Now, 4G is in a different spot now, you know, and all that. But so that was truthfully one of the things that really kind of inspired me to join the company, because I knew that if I did good and work hard, and accelerated that I could go far at a young age. Because I didn't have a lot of patience. I didn't want to spend, you know, lifetime learning and then...
Yeah, and then wait. Yeah. So at this point, now you have a friend, colleague named Carmen Chen Wu. So I know you have some history with her. And a lot of people assume that she's your wife's last partner. She is none of the above.
None of it.
And none of the above. And talk a little bit about how that came to be, like, because I know you knew her from your childhood and like, how did all that, like, hey, let's just start a handbag brand. Let's give it a name it after you. And by the way, my wife is going to know that I'm with you all the time. And it's like a very interesting dynamic. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the juicy stuff, right?
Because a lot of people don't know that. Yeah. I know because I'm privy to that because you were through the Handbag Awards. We had a micro licensing deal that never went anywhere. Thank God. I'm so happy it didn't because, you know, you pivoted right after. Not taking credit for it, but maybe I will a tiny bit. But for you to speak about how Carmen Chen Wu came to be and then what prompted Kara to magically appear right after.
Yeah, no, it's been a wonderful journey. So right after, you know, the whole thing I mentioned about GE and business school and all that, you know, back in 2012, 2013, I was ready to take that jump, right? A lot of things just fall into place. And I said, this is it.
How old are you?
I was in my early 30s.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's honestly also part of the reason why I say it's even either now or or I wouldn't say never, because I see a lot of successful entrepreneurs that started in the 40s, even 50s.
But for you, it was now or now. That's it.
For me, it felt right. You know, it felt that the timing was right. There was a lot of things in the family side of things that also were ready.
And you had obviously saved a nice chunk of money to give you this buffer to start a business, because you can't do it for.
Not enough. But yes, you know, it was planned to a certain extent. I like to say it was planned for the long time. Reality probably was planned more like 6 months. And I knew I want to be in fashion. I knew I want to be in the handbag because of the leg up that my family has in the supply chain of the things, right?
Yeah.
But I, again, was smart enough to know that I'm not a designer, right? I don't even know how to draw, you know,
that's
to be honest.
Wild.
You know, like it's, I think I'm a good merchandiser at this point. I think
that's just as important, if not more, I think.
I would agree. But, you know, I said to really create a contemporary handbag brand, and I've seen it from other brands that my parents either helped or invested in. So, you know, I've seen a lot of kind of, you know, evolution of other brands on the sidelines. And I'm like, this thing's never going to go anywhere without just a rock star designer, right? And interesting enough, so Carmen is also from Spain. So Carmen Chen Wu is my co-founder and the spirit animal of our brand, the muse and the spirit animal. And she's the core of Kara, you know. And now I can say this.
If you ever wanted to start a handbag brand and you didn't know where to start, this is for you. If you had dreams of becoming a handbag designer but aren't trained in design, this is for you. If you have a handbag brand and need strategy and direction, this is for you. I'm Emily Blumenthal, handbag designer expert and handbag fairy godmother, and this is the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass. Over the next 10 classes, I will break down everything you need to know to make, manufacture, and market a handbag brand, broken down to ensure that you will not only skip steps in the handbag building process, but also to save money to avoid the learning curve of costly mistakes. For the past 20 years, I've been teaching at the top fashion universities in New York City, wrote the Handbag Designer Bible, founded the Handbag Awards, and created the only Handbag Designer podcast. I'm going to show you, like I have countless brands, to create in this in-depth course from sketch to sample to sale, whether you're just starting out and don't even know where to start or begin, or if you've had a brand and need some strategic direction, the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass is just for you. So let's get started, and you'll be the creator of the next it bag. Join me, Emily Blumenthal, in the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass. So be sure to sign up at emilyblumenthal.com/masterclass and type in the code podcast to get 10% off your masterclass today.
how did you find her, reconnect with her, collect her? I mean, again, I know that how many Chinese were there in Spain at that time? You know,
not many.
See each other at the meetings. You
know? No many. So our families knew each other from the Spanish days, right? So my grandfather, like I mentioned before, he was one of the early Chinese to establish himself in Spain. And he was a lawyer. He was a lawyer by trade. And he also happened to love the Spanish culture and the Spanish language. And because of that, he picked up Spanish very early on. And in translation, he essentially used his skills to help a lot of entrepreneurs in Spain to start Chinese restaurants or other businesses. You know, as you can imagine, if you move from China to Spain, even if you had funds to invest in, unless you know the local, you know, language or so on and so forth, you need a lawyer basically on your side to start, you know, businesses. And
Carmen, you also need to know how much of the Chinese food needs to be Chinese to sell.
So, right.
Having been in Spain and studied in Sevilla and Asturias, I've been all over, like any Chinese restaurant you go in, especially as an American, you're like, please let them have something that I can identify with. So understanding the sellability of a customer is like just important.
That's right. Because you know, a lot of dishes are actually, quote unquote, translated to Spanish palates, right?
Yeah.
They're not truly authentic. Now things has changed. But back then, a spring roll is not the spring rolls that probably we're used to in the States or in China, right? It was like a very thin crust, you know, a lot of juicy veggies inside with a few pieces of meat. In Spain, it's totally different. It's very thick crust, not very juicy. Anyways, it's translated.
I would love to. I mean, your next bag should be like called the Spanish spring roll, because I think there's so much in that right there. That's like a whole story in itself. Okay, so your grandfather knew Carmen's grandfather?
Grandmother. And, you know, honestly, I was just doing a little research in the States and just stumbled upon Carmen. You know, she's, of course, a CFDA awarded fashion designer, top of the class in Parsons, you know, won numerous awards beforehand, and happens to be Chinese from Valencia, you know, which is so.
Not so common.
Not common at all. And
so were you just digging for designers and looking for someone who is Chinese? Like, how did you, like...
It was a combination of things. It was a little bit of that. It was a little bit of, you know, talking to my parents as far as, you know, what venues and what different areas I can, you know, kind of tap into. And they brought up, hey, you know, I think, you know, so-and-so's granddaughter, actually, it's in the States. It's just wild, right?
Wow.
You know, it's really fate. It's really a unicorn story in the sense that...
There's a saying in Yiddish or German, however you want to call it, called beschert. And it means it is written. Like, this was predetermined, predestined to happen.
Yeah. No, it really was. It was magic. And because, you know, how many times can you say that everything just fell into place all at once, right? Is that I'm ready to start a brand, handbag specifically, contemporary. You know, back then, Carmen was ready to do a very similar kind of a jump, right, in terms of a career. And
when you reached out to her, was she like, who are you? Or my grandma told me you were calling.
No, she didn't know. But the introduction was that, hey, you know, I think our grandparents know each other. Matter of fact, they did business together, right?
Did you write her in Spanish or English?
In English. It was in English. And we started just gelling right away. You know, it's like our backgrounds are so similar. We both have the same interests, you know, in terms of wanting to start a fashion brand. I love her design aesthetic. I mean, and I'm not saying this just because she's my, you know, business partner and co-founder of the brand. I think she's one of the most talented handbag designers that I've known, and I've seen my fair share of them.
100%.
You know, when I see her drawing and thinking through concepts with her team and merchandising conversations and all that, it's magic to see things coming out of thin air, you know, when she's at work.
Was that weird for your wife?
No, you know, I think
it's a little strange. Like, hey, I found this girl.
Yeah.
I'm going to spend all my time with her. We're going to start a business. And don't worry, I'm going to tell everybody we're not together. So, yeah. I mean, honestly, because that's just the assumption.
Yeah, you know, and we got a lot of that, right? It's that, to your point, everybody assumes that we're together, we're married, and all that. I think, you know, obviously, transparency, it's very critical in any relationship, right? So being upfront with that, I think it's important. I think, you know, again, my wife, and I'm sure she'd be okay with me saying this, my wife is a very confident woman, Okay.
She's just fine.
She's very confident in our marriage, in our relationship, and in herself, of course. And so, you know, I say this is somewhat of a fairy tale because Carmen and I have been working on this brand and, you know, other ventures and so on and so forth and other brands for the last 10 years together. We hardly ever fight. And that's a question I get a lot in interviews from the press is that, you know, like, how is it like to have a co-founder, right? And it's hard. It's hard, Emily. And you've seen your fair share of startup brands. Co-founders fight and they split up. Matter of fact, you know, I read this somewhere not that long ago that I think over 50% of brands, especially in retail and fashion, that ends up, you know, dissolving or going away or being sold, whatever it is, it's not because the brand couldn't sustain or it's because of differences between the co-founders, you know.
I mean, it's a divorce like anything else. It's
yes.
hard. You know, you start out kind of in this bubble and then when interest, attention, growth, ego, scale, you know, there's always, because you both can't be doing the exact same thing. Like one person has to be designated to one and then designated to another. And, you know, differences of opinions come and then you have to come up very quickly with a way that you can determine what is more important to one person versus what is more like, is this a 10 for you or a 2 for you? Because if it's a 2 for me and it's 10 for you, we'll just go with that. That's it. The end.
Yep. 100%. Very, very hard. And the fact that we worked with each other for 10 years and build an amazing brand and building on the second one as we speak, it's a miracle, honestly. And we reflect on our journey, right, from time to time. You know, we're so busy that we don't get the chance to really reflect too often. But a lot of it's based out of, well, to your point earlier, right, the skill sets has to complement each other, never, yeah. you know, conflict or contract each other. Because right. then you're going to end up in a situation where both of you want to make a call and who's going to make that call at the end of the day, right? And that's where the friction happens.
How did you go from Carmen Chen Wu and being like, hey, girl, we're going to call it after you because you're the talent to, hey, I think it's time to pivot and let's call it something else?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of things in the early days. I think, you know, Carmen, when we started Kara, or we started working together before we even landed on the name of Kara, you know, there was Carmen Chen Wu, her namesake brand.
I know you did CCW or Carmen, CCW came
that's
after.
Right. That's right. And I think at one point we both came to conclusion, more Carmen than me, because I actually was totally okay with just continue calling, you know, Carmen Chen Wu or CCW.
It's a cool name.
It's a great name. It's a great name. And even the short of it, it's wonderful. I think, you know, she did not want to create a brand, a namesake brand. I think that's her vision, right? Is that, you know, the brand should sustain itself without a designer. And again, there's plenty of brands out there that, you know, even after the brand was sold, right, and the designer is no longer involved more as a figure, they continue to be very successful. That's great. And I'm not saying that cannot be the case. But for her, she won the brand that is not necessarily always tied to her persona to a certain extent, even though she is the spirit animal behind the brand and, you know, the nucleus of the brand for the last decade. She won the brand that basically can last forever, even though we both are not here, right? So,
right.
Kara, I don't know if you know this, it's a combination of her name and my name together.
I did. Of course I did.
Of course it did.
Karen.
So you probably know this, but for those who don't know, one of the things that we really pride ourselves, you know, in Kara specifically was that besides being, you know, just a beautiful product, right, in terms of design and the materials that we use, it's extremely functional. It's a very functional handbag.
You know, different aesthetic product and so forth from Carmen Chen Wu with CCW. That was very fashion driven. Not that these aren't, but this was very, you know, the lane was very crowded where you were to Kara. And if I'm not mistaken, you yourself were also on a reality show for a minute trying to pitch and get money. Like, honey, funny, I know all those stories. Everything in the closet.
Yeah.
And they weren't very kind to you also, which really pissed me off.
Yeah.
Like, I know his vision and I know the people who were on the other side, like, well, do you get it? I'm like, he gets it. Watch the space.
Yeah. No.
So being an early adopter into athleisure for a handbag, you're up against a lot. It's like being a pioneer is good, but it's also, you want to be the first, the fastest and the best, But then the flip side of that is like, you're the one paving the way, which is almost just as problematic.
It was hard. It was hard. We got slapped left and right in the early days, you know? So yes, we were in Project Runway, or spinoff, I think, of the project.
Yeah, right? It was Project Entrepreneur or something like that.
Yeah, you're right. I think it was Project Entrepreneur. Great memory, Emily.
Don't go there. It's all there, Aaron. It's all there.
How do you do it? So yeah, it was fun. You know, we, of course, I can go on forever about funding, by the way. Okay. You know, in terms, I think funding, it's a very slipping slope when it comes to fashion brands. And, you know, we were involved in a number of, you know, accelerators, you know, and pre-venture funding organizations in the early days. And I got a very inside look into venture funding. Of course, given my finance background, you know, I was fortunate enough, because I was with GE, I was fortunate enough to see so many different pitches and deals coming through my desk. And I got to tell you, like, you know, I don't say I'm 100% disagreeing, but I think venture funding and fashion brands doesn't really work, you know, in the early days.
What you were going to say.
It's
the wrong industry. It's like doing it for food. It's the fashion is too quick. The trends move too fast. The customer is too fickle. You get stuck with inventory. That's a plus on the balance sheet, but it's truly a minus. You know, your fashion is, you're driving the car off the lot and hoping for the best that it doesn't lose value as soon as it leaves the store.
Yeah.
You can't. And
no.
It's funny that you going in with a finance background assume that that's the road, but it's not. And that's a learning curve on your part. You had no choice but to get it backwards.
And you're going to realize we started the brand in 2013, 2014, right? And part of the reason why we wanted to start Kara specifically was that we saw great DTC brands that came before us. Called it digital native back then, or the, you know, digital first, later on DTC. I think the terms keep changing. But we saw some great brands coming before us, Bonobos and Everlane and...
Yeah. Dollar Kuyana and all those. Yep.
Exactly. And what's interesting, you know, Kuyana might be a slightly different story. Kind of the same, but...
Ish.
But, you know, Outdoor Voices, right? All those brands, like when we start looking into kind of the funding story...
Well, don't go to Outdoor Voices now. So,
yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's exactly the point, right? Is that a lot of them, they were great marketers. There was so much to learn when it comes to branding and marketing, right? I mean, think about Bonobos. When Andy Dunn started the brand with Brian, you know, the concept was different. It really was in the sense that, right? It's that... You know, you buy a product, it's directly coming to you. Not that DTC didn't exist before, of course, the concept was always there, but he really leveraged tech, right? And then cheap advertising through Instagram and Facebook to really get the story out. And it was a great business model. But one thing we realized was that, hey, when it comes to the product,
You
know, it's like, it's not bad. I'm not trashing any brands, but it was like,
Right.
And we're just like, okay. And by the way, I wanted to love Bonobos and just picking Andy for a minute, right?
Well, as a men's brand, like that was the space that no one had touched.
That was.
I get that. And their marketing was genius.
Great marketing.
Yes. I mean, I've been professoring long before they started. And when I saw it coming up, it's like, wow, look at this white space that they hit that they really can't get pushback because no one's doing it. Much like, you know, Kara in that regard. But you're so spot on that the product doesn't fit the narrative. It's like the narrative can only get you to a certain point because you need the product to make it all the way around the bases.
And you talk about LTV, right? So, you know, lifetime value of the customer. You know, if your product is but your marketing is really good, you will get probably a cheap acquisition to acquire the customer, right? Your first time acquiring the customer might be cheap because of the story you tell. But when you think about the lifetime and the repeatability of that customer, that comes not from branding, that comes from product.
Product. Right?
Exactly.
That's your 80-20.
That's right. And it's interesting because their whole pitch back then was that, hey, I can lose a little bit of money with, you know, first-time acquisition of the customer because I'm betting on the fact they're going to come back later on. So my LTV, ultimately, it's very high, even though my acquisition cost is very high in the early days, right? And again, if your product is not superior, honestly, that equation is going to fail. And I saw that. I saw that. And by the way, you know, not to say that I have the foresight of seeing the future, but the reality is that a lot of this brand ends up actually failing, right?
Yeah.
And I can say that because some of them did end up failing. because that thesis is wrong. That thesis is totally wrong. You cannot lose, you know, even Casper, you know, that they were saying that, okay, we don't have LTV, you know, so I'm okay with acquiring a little bit more, paying a little bit more on acquisition first because my margins are so high. It ends up, you know, not working out. And of course, you know, that's a different story for another day. But anyways, to answer your question in terms of how we thought about this, we said, look, we have a super talented design team, right? Well, back then it was just one designer, but, you know, now we have a team. But, you know, Carmen is a rock star. So what if we learn everything we know about DTC, the four mothers and forefathers that came before us, right? In terms of narrative, storytelling, branding, and so on and so forth, but flip the equation a little bit and really let the product actually shine. And we were fortunate enough to actually, you know, kind of really identify a spot that nobody were really doing it, right?
How did you, the pair of you being like, at leisure, let's do a bag for that. Because how did that happen? After doing a fashion brand that did okay, it didn't, like, it's not Kara level, but how were you like, I think this is our lane to go in?
Yeah. And that was an interesting kind of how we landed in the concept. So we actually didn't even want to be associated in the early days with athleisure. You know, it was a little bit of a fad back then.
Right.
You know, everybody was like, you know, is this here to stay? Is this, you know, and then I got an interview in the early days, like, well, what do you think about athleisure? And I'm like, I have no idea. But one thing I can tell you is that healthy living, it's here to stay. Right.
Right.
So when we start looking at data, both Carmen and I are super data oriented, we start realizing A, that people's lifestyle starts to change.
Right.
And people are working out a lot more, being a lot more health conscious. And, you know, for being in a metro area like New York, people are constantly on the go, right? And we see so many customers or just consumers in general with 2 or 3 bags on the street. I mean, you can see, right?
Oh, yeah.
One for the gym, one for the office, one for going out. And we're like,
I love when people say it's a day to night bag because you and I both know that that does not exist.
No, it doesn't. No. It doesn't. No. So we said, what if we give her a bag? And back then, you know, one of our early partnerships that we had was with Equinox, right? So we kind of leveraged them or used their customers almost like model customer to a certain extent. Like,
right. Well,
if we were going to service an Equinox customer, right? What kind of bag will she need? What she's going to wear? Again, Fast Company and a few other editorials called us the brand that invented the athleisure handbag. I didn't coin that term, but I take it, you know?
Own it. Yeah, I know. Listen, people call me a fairy godmother. You could be called much worse.
Yeah.
So,
that's right.
That's how I see it.
So you know, we're like, you know what? Let's just run with it. But that was the genesis of the brand, is that we felt that, look, to your point earlier too, there's so many great handbag brands out there. So many, right? From luxury all the way down to contemporary. And we just felt that if your value proposition to convince a customer to buy your product is because I can do it better or my prettier, that's a very hard proposition to convince other people. It takes a lot of dollars to see it on the celebrities. It just takes a long journey.
My God, forget it. And the interesting thing, this aspiration of influencer or creator, whatever you want to call it, gifting it to people, that comes at such a cost because the ROI for that 9 times out of 10 is so low and people don't even realize that. Like
100%.
You know, back 100%. In the day, you gift it to a stylist, hope that the celebrity wears it, then hope it shows up in Us Weekly or People Style Watch, RIP, almost all of them in print. And now it's like you need the validation of your customer being a brand with fans and really catering to their personal needs and identifying that through your site and building that community. Because without that community, you have no brand.
100%. You have to have that first party data in order for you to actually be a sustainable brand. You know, without that, you are at the mercy of others to, you know, you are at the will in terms of how do you tell the story. So yes, that was kind of the genesis, you know, behind the brand in the early days where we said, look, I think, you know, there is a space where we know that we want to be contemporary, we want to be aspirational, but we want to make our product a lot more functional. And for us, functionality means first and foremost, material science. So we invest a lot of R&D into developing and using different nylons. Nylon is probably one of the key fabrics that we use.
Is the production done still through your family's factories?
Not anymore. It used to be, but a lot of great connections that we have. You know,
was that hard to like move away?
No,
like
no, no.
Internally being like, hey guys, we can't do this anymore because this does not fit our model.
No, no, no. It wasn't necessarily fitting our model. It was just because the price point, honestly, didn't, you know,
because you were more expensive than what they were doing.
We just got bigger. We got bigger and the volume just got to a certain point that we can get a lot more economy of scale with larger factories.
Right.
My family factory is still, I would say, probably mid-size. Again, large factory, there's bad ones and there's great ones.
100%.
Right? The really great ones are the ones that, you know, respects and values design and quality, but still gives you the economy of scale. So that's kind of what we're looking for on the supply chain side and the production side of things. But yeah, so back to what I was saying, functionality from very early on, and we're still very much leaning on those pillars, is material science. You know, you have to make sure that you use an exquisite product that's durable, that's light, that feels, you know, silky and buttery on the touch. You know, all that comes with R&D investment.
100%.
We also invest heavily in different ways that you can carry the product, right? When it comes to design, multi-strap system is one of the key design features that we, you know, always rely on. You know, when it comes to pockets, you know, a lot of people is like, you know, the more the merrier. We disagree. You know, when it comes to pockets, we feel like, you know, pockets needs to be designed thoughtfully and has to have a purpose, right?
100%.
Sticking in a few pockets just because everybody else is doing it or because we feel like just give, you know, some compartment for the user, that's not right. And so we spend a lot of time researching, working with, you know, our ambassadors. You know, we have a pretty decent sized ambassador program at this point, not only to help us tell the story, you know, in terms of the brand and of course carry our products, but also their feedback. It's very valuable to the design.
To identify what's missing, to identify what we need. Oh, this didn't work. I would like this. Can you do that?
Yep. And again, we don't always listen to our customers, right? Because
that's to the extent, like, I want it in yellow. Guess what? Yellow doesn't sell or whatever, something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, Carmen likes to say always that, you know, the great designers at the end of the day are the ones who will tell you something that you need before you know you may need it, right?
Bingo. Yep.
So asking your consumers to always help you design, you know, it's one data point, you know?
Whenever I see people doing this, help designer back, and I'm like, oh, honey bunny, that's the wrong way to go. Yeah. Or whenever I see a new brand saying it's bespoke, it's like, ah, you bought too many materials. You don't know how to do this. You don't know how to scale. It's like red flags to me that I think a lot of customers are a lot more savvy than what you think they are when you're trying to sell them something.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, just to quickly touch on that point, you know, look, customers are more savvy than ever, you know, especially with Gen Z, and much more than before. And, you know, of course, with all the return policies that, you know, most brands have, you know, if you are BSing your customers through marketing, worst case scenario, they will actually not even return the product and don't ever buy it from you again. Best case scenario is they come back, tell you why they didn't like the product and perhaps exchange for something, right?
Right.
So point is that I think to your point, you know, you can't fool a customer these days, you know, not anymore in terms of, and I don't think you ever could in the past, but.
Oh, but now with the way that people can communicate, no way, forget it. You Google 100%. One bad review, that's there for life.
Like, no, 100%.
It's not going anywhere.
100%.
Aaron, I would love to know where Kara is going, Mercado Famous, wrap all this into one big bow. What's to come? Where are we now?
Yeah. So Carmen and I have been working with each other for a decade, but, you know, Kara, it's been around probably for 8 years, you know, 7 or 8 years. I think for us, you know, we're ready to scale. You know, it's very funny because a lot of people want to scale early. And that's, you know, back to my point about VCs before, because as soon as you start taking external funding, you're obligated to your investors. You have fiduciary duty to your investors to actually grow for them and for yourself, but for them also because they're on the same boat as you. And that's prone to make mistakes, to your point.
Right? Yeah.
So we took really cautious baby steps in our early journey. I think, you know, the brand is at a point where our supply chain is robust. Our team, you know, we finally are at the point where we feel like we have a right-sized team to help us scale. So I think you can expect us to grow significantly, I think, in the next 3 to 4 years. I don't know if we're ever going to expand beyond accessories. You know, I think when I say we, Carmen and myself, but Carmen believes in the value of being specialist in something, right?
Be the best at something.
Exactly. So when people think about, oh, functional travel bag or functional baby bag or, you know, functional pet bag or sports bag.
Feel a bag.
Exactly.
Feel a bag.
go to the back brand that specializes versus go to a quote unquote lifestyle brand, right? Which is like has a lot of everything, but it's like,
still a bag.
100%.
Stick to what you're good at.
So that's that. You know, I think, you know, we started a second brand called Mercado Famous. We bring Spanish charcuterie to the States. Very different brand. Honestly, started as, you know, a passion project because our love to Spain and because we just got frustrated not be able to find good charcuterie in the States from Spain. So, and we, you know, if you haven't seen the website, we have great swag, you know. So part of kind of the, you know, the, we joke around and say the part of the intangible benefits that comes with Mercado Famous is that we actually can bring really great hoodies from some of the luxury factories that we know. So,
there's your opportunity to the lifestyle.
Maybe, yeah. You know, use that as a platform.
Listen, if I'm going to get homeowner or chorizo, I want to see it on a hoodie. The end. That's it.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree. So we're going to continue growing that brand. I think it's getting a lot of love. You know, I think we pay a lot of attention to branding and design. The product comes from an organic farm with a 100-year-old recipe that treats the pig the right way. We never use the word kill. We always use the word sacrifice because we're sacrificing the animal for the consumption of humans. So very excited about the brand. You will see us growing there. And, you know, we're starting to help others, you know, help other brands to maneuver through maybe some challenges they have. You know, I don't want to say that we are, you know, starting to give back because we're not there yet. But I think, you know, we make small investments where we see those things happen and we see a fit. So we'll be doing some of that as well along the way. But we primarily is blowout Cara, you know, in terms of, I feel like we're at the point where, you know, the tipping point where you've been growing. You know, I remember I was not that long ago in a conference in Miami. You know, I was in the room full of, you know, ladies and, you know, Cara, it's a woman's brand, you know, one service man. And I was telling the story of Cara. Everybody's kind of listening to me. And at the end of my spiel, I guess, they're like, why haven't I heard about this brand before? Like, you're just speaking my ear, you know, like I need this.
Right.
And that's the trade-off, right? That's a trade-off of not over advertising or marketing your product, you know, because we didn't want to spend all the dollars, right?
Yeah.
In that function.
That is a trade-off.
That's right.
100%.
That's right. So, you know, now that we are at the point where we feel like financially we can tell the bigger story or to a wider audience, you're going to see a lot of us, hopefully.
Man, I am here for it. Aaron, how do we follow you? Learn more.
Yeah. So you can find Cara at cara.co. So it's caraa.co. You can also follow us on Instagram. Instagram, you know, it's primarily the platform we use together with TikTok. I think we're getting better at TikTok. But when it comes to social media, I think Instagram is the best place to find us. You can find us at Cara Sport. That's the handle. And then for those of you who are aficionados and lovers of meats and Spanish meats specifically, you can find Mercado at mercadofamous.com. And then same way on Instagram, the handle is Mercado Famous.
Love it. I am here for the meats. I'm here for the bags. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us with Handbag Designer 101. Man, we are following, eating, wearing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a fun conversation. And yeah, thanks again.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate and review and follow us on every single platform at Handbag Designer. Thanks so much. See you next time.